This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Well, we were all ready to spend the next hour or so moaning about what went wrong in the Manchester derby, but then along comes a bit of a bonkers game against Southampton to shake things up a little. A win's a win, and it was an emphatic one at 5-2, but was the performance up to what was needed after limping to defeat against United? Not only that, our old friend the video assistant referee is back in the spotlight after one of the most ludicrous penalty decisions you'll ever see, so expect that to come up at some point in this week's Blue Moon Podcast too. Also on today's show, we'll be looking ahead to the upcoming fixtures with Fulham and Borussia Mönchengladbach. We'll hear from football historian Dr. Gary James about the worst ever top flight title defence. Yes, it is City's. And journalist Rafael Hernandez speaks to the show about the Barcelona elections and what that could mean for City and Lionel Messi. I'm David Mooney, and for this week's show, I'm joined by, from statcity.co.uk, Adam Carter.
Hello.
And the Daily Mail's Jack Gorn.
Hello, hello. You all right?
I'm not too bad, thanks. Adam, you well?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you very much.
Good, good. I think I mentioned it in the introduction, the VAR stuff. We kind of have to start there, even though that's not really where I want to start for this week's show. The big headline, obviously, from the Southampton game was the penalty or not that was on Phil Foden. He told Sky after the game that he was trying to stay on his feet. This is what Pep Guardiola then had to say to Jeff Shreves afterwards.
I don't understand why Fulham disallowed the goal against Tottenham. I don't understand the hands from Arsenal against Burnley. And another example is the penalty today. Like, we won, it's incredible, happy, and you know, and everything. John cannot see it, but the VAR is there. Don't whistle the penalty, it's incredible. You know that for a long time, and maybe in 4 or 5 years, never complain about the referees and the action, but this action is really incredible. Incredible.
Are you just bemused quite regularly as to what decisions are? And you're not the only manager saying this.
The VAR exists for the referees don't see the action, can make a mistake. That's why you review. But if it's a review, don't whistle the penalty this action. So I don't understand, honestly. The same with the Fulham, Arsenal, so the hands. Maybe one day they will explain this, really the rule for all the managers, all the players. But the penalty today, okay, it's 5-2. At the moment it was 1-1. If we are not able to win today because the quality of the opponent, we are just... Not just, it's enough. 8 points clear, and in that moment is 1-1. So
could have been
that's
very
why
different.
I'm the proud because in this club, I don't know in other ones, but in this club, what we have done this decade or the last years, we won it. We did it for ourselves. That's for sure.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast.
Guardiola, understandably, not very happy with the decision. And just in case you two fellas were wondering, I have isolated that bit just in case we need it later on in the show.
Incredible.
Just in case either of you come up with a point that I feel is yeah, worthy of hearing that.
I mean, for the ages.
Yeah, there we go. I mean, in all seriousness, Jack, you look at the two penalty incidents in the game. How is it not given? Like what?
Well, they were both penalties, weren't they?
Yeah. What's happened there?
What's happened? Well, the explanation from the Premier League afterwards was that there was inconclusive evidence. Or they couldn't definitively say that McCarthy didn't touch the ball, which, when that came through, I was staggered because we've all... I mean, we don't get as many replays in the stadium as people watching from home, and certainly not, obviously not as many as Stockley Park. And we got two or three, and it's like, well, obviously he's not touched the ball. I mean, it's just... There's not a great deal to say about it. It's just so bafflingly wrong that it's not an argument about VAR, is it? It's an argument about the competency of the officials.
Yeah.
And that's why the problem, that's why the debate around VAR is so tricky, because really the technology that they're using should make the game fairer and should make the game clearer, but it doesn't, because the people that are behind the screens clearly don't know what they're doing. I mean, I turned around to I sat next to Paul Hurst last night, and I turned around to him when Moss didn't give it. I was like, well, he's not giving it because he knows that VAR are going to give it, because everyone sat in the ground knew that was a penalty. But you can just see it with your naked eye, it's obvious. Like, Foden's foot was hanging off, so so it's like, well, obviously he's going to give it, and they're just waiting to see if they can score anyway. And I'm real, I'd start like writing my notes that, you know, City got a penalty, you know, miscontrolled a back pass, Foden nipped in, whatever. And then it turns around and, oh no, it's, they've not given it. It's just absolutely astonishing.
The thing that I find most baffling about that explanation, Adam, is when you consider that the line is that the VAR, the video assistant referee, couldn't see whether or not McCarthy touched the ball in that challenge. When you're going for criminal convictions, the juries are told beyond reasonable doubt. I mean, if that's the level of reasonable doubt we're going for with the VAR, the bar is too high, isn't it?
Exactly. It's not a legal enterprise, is it, in terms of the on-field activities. Jack's hit the nail on the head there. The referee has been able to bottle that because he knows VAR will pick it up afterwards, so he doesn't have to give it. But that just negates any accountability, be it on the pitch or on the VAR side, because if one's saying, oh, I'm waiting for him to give it, and the other side saying, I'm waiting for him to give it, we're just in this grey area and nothing happens. But it shouldn't have even got that far. If we just look at the decision on it as a standalone, like you say, the incompetency there is him not being able to see that whether the keeper's played the ball or not, which he didn't. And that was, like Jack says there, that was visible to the naked eye in the stadium. Yes, we've got a bit of luxury in the watching from home in terms of the camera angles we have access to on Sky Sports. I saw it, and I don't profess to be, you know, a Hawkeye with these type of things, but I saw it in real time. Usually sometimes you have to wait for replays and say, actually, yeah, it was. I could see straight away it was a penalty. And what you know how much of a clangor it is when rival fans on Twitter, that's my barometer for the level of how wrong this was, when they're chiming up and saying that is ridiculous. That we didn't get it. So it's not even a VAR issue. I mean, it's completely the VAR issue, but it shouldn't have even got to that stage. That should have only just been like a clarification measure.
Jack, even if McCarthy has got a little stud on the ball, is it not still a foul?
Yeah, anywhere else on the pitch, it's definitely a foul, even if you touch the ball. I mean, how many times do you see defenders go through an attacker and you go, well, they've got the ball, and then they're booked or... you know, or it's a free kick and they get a yellow card. It now doesn't matter if you get a little bit of the ball. So that the kind of explanation from the Premier League was even stranger, really, given that he clearly, like, took his foot away. I mean, it's just so, like... you've got a player running through who wants to stay on his feet, can't stay on his feet. It's impossible for him to stay on his feet because one of them's been wiped
chopped away.
Under him.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I just don't get it. And anyone who's watched football for any length of time knew that as it happened, everyone went penalty. Obviously, it's a penalty. So I don't understand how you can know. Everybody can know for absolute certain that it was a penalty while it was happening. And then for them not to give it after watching however many replays, it's just, I don't know. But Pep's completely right in the sense that he doesn't complain about referees, and that's kind of sometimes to his detriment that he doesn't complain about referees. And certainly, it can wind us up a little bit because after they've gone out in the Champions League or they've suffered bad results, and you know. Refereeing decisions have contributed to those results. He just steadfastly refuses to talk about it, which is a little bit annoying from our point of view. But he made a point. Like last night, City scored 5 goals. They've won fairly emphatically, despite not playing particularly brilliantly. This is his time to say, no, this is a joke, because he knows that people will take notice because they've won the game.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Jack says there as well that Southampton's penalty was a penalty. What are your feelings, Adam? Because, I mean, like we're saying there, contact on the ball is not a clean tackle. So contact on a body is not a foul either. And Laporte, I mean, has he pulled him back or has he just kind of touched him and he's thrown himself over?
They've definitely made a meal of it. But my argument was I didn't complain at the time because I thought, well, Laporte's got his hand on him, so he's given the ref the opportunity to give the penalty. In my book, it's nowhere near a foul. There's nowhere near enough momentum to drag a 6-foot-odd lad down to the ground in such emphatic fashion. So it's nowhere near a penalty yet. But in terms of his hand being there has let John Moss given that penalty, and that's why I can't complain. That's my personal view of it. But He had every right to go down, to be fair to him, because Laporte had his hand on his shoulder. But it's a ridiculous, you know, theatrics from him.
But that's one of those, though, isn't it? If that's at the other end,
yeah,
I think City fans probably want a penalty for that, don't they? And yeah, that's probably quite a good barometer.
Well, here's the question then, Jack. Is like, should Foden have done that? Should Foden have stayed down, thrown himself over and rolled around?
Yeah, well, I tweeted after. He should have screamed. If he'd screamed, he'd got it. Yes, is the obvious answer, but it's kind of heartening that he wanted to go around him and score or set someone else up. That's the sort of thing when Pep talks about Foden, which is obviously quite often because he gets asked about it quite a lot. He always talks about him being like a kid and like a child, and he always says he wants to eat the world. And that, I thought that was kind of proof of that last night, in that his honesty, he just wants to play. He just wants to finish the move. And maybe he needs to get a little bit more streetwise, but it'd be a shame to take that honesty out of his game, because that's part of the reason why he's such a
likeable, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just on, while we're on penalties, and let's kind of box it all off in one go. There was a couple of appeals in the derby as well, Adam, that City didn't get. I have really struggled to find replays of both the Sterling and Jesus incidents. When you were watching them in real time, what did you make of them?
Have they just disappeared into a black hole now because it was our penalties, the footage? I thought there was a... I would have liked to have seen a bit more of... the TV studio decides what replays we see. So it almost appears that... So when I'm talking about the Sterling one where Fred ran across him and he went through Fred's legs, if we discuss that incident, the TV didn't make any nod to that at all. I think we should show one or two replays. And I think the ones where the play stops and it's reviewed, and whether it's given or not, you get a bit more of, okay, well, they've reviewed it. Wrong or rightly, they've took the time to do it. Whereas the ones that don't get shown on TV, us as fans are just like, well, did they even look at it? And then we're told, obviously, they did look at it, but there's never any permanent clarification or any visual that they're replaying that even while the game's going on. So that felt like it was just thrown to the discard pile. And like you say, you've not been able to find any, you know, any discussions of it thereafter. So that's the Sterling one I thought was a penalty, and I've seen them given in previous games. But it just felt like it wasn't going to be our day in terms of from the opening minute, really. So yeah, I didn't expect anything else to go in our favour.
That's the thing, isn't it, Jack? I mean, like, as much as we can sit here and say, oh, well, that could have been a penalty, that could have been a penalty on Jesus as well. Like, the narrative of the day is that City didn't play very well, and that's because City didn't play very well and United were better.
Yeah, no, they didn't play very well. Although he said that they played better than they played against West Ham, which I thought they were fairly similar in both games. I don't think they've played particularly well for quite a few weeks now. And the great thing towards the end of the winning run was that they were beating teams without playing particularly brilliantly. I mean, take the Mönchengladbach game. I didn't think they were particularly great that night, but they just had complete control of it. And they were able to, you know, if they score in the first half an hour, they can just kill a game. The problem is when they don't score in the first half an hour, I just get the feeling that some of them, particularly the midfield, occasionally try and force it a little bit too quickly. And panic's the wrong word, but it just feels everything feels a little bit too quick, and they just want to play
tense,
that final
maybe.
Ball. But maybe tense in themselves, yeah, and it's... just triggered to play a ball too quick rather than, you know, recycling passes for another five or six and trying to pick holes. I think De Bruyne is particularly guilty of that. But then you kind of look at those performances in the context of the season and say, well, there are going to be dips. And actually, if the last kind of 3 or 4 weeks has been a dip in performances, then it's been a staggeringly good season. And will be a great season, won't it? But if this is it, this is a low point, then they'll turn around and go, well, thanks very much.
Yeah, it was the performance against United was obviously flat, Adam. As a fan, when you saw the game against Southampton, how did you feel about the response? Because I certainly felt for the first 10 minutes at least, I was thinking, this is the same game again.
Yeah, I think I was looking back at the fixtures around that game, and we've not particularly played well since, I'd say, around the Tottenham or Everton game, which was about 6 games ago. We've battled through previous games, and it looked like a carbon copy in that first 10 minutes. I love how Sky, for anyone who was watching, after like 6 minutes put up the possession stats because it was 75% in Saints' favour. And I just thought that's usually reserved for 10, 15 minutes in. But when they can bash us with a stat like that, I'm all for it.
It showed how slowly City had started in the second game running, though.
It was sluggish. It looked a bit hungover. I go back to what you guys just said about that tension. We looked to be playing within ourselves at that point. There was so many stray balls in that first 10 minutes that were just going out of touch. Walker's side, Zinchenko's side. Zinchenko, who's played well recently but loves giving the ball to Southampton 3 seasons in a row, he loves passing to them. I think he's a Saints fan, definitely. And it was just a case of here we go again. And then it's weird because you've got to temper it in the crisis stakes, because by any stretch of the imagination, one defeat in 30 games is anything from that. And we've got the luxury of having quality players that can dig us out of holes. But you just get that sense of, okay, so say if today isn't going to be our day again, that's how I thought of United. You can have one bad day at the office. You can't have two. That's my kind of barometer. And I thought, oh, here's the second one. And then you start looking over your shoulder. And I know it's ridiculous, but it's probably typical City-itis that you start saying, oh, well, there's 8 points, and we made 8 points up on United famously in 2012, so it can happen. We're at the business end of the season now. Is it starting to get to us? And then we just do a absolutely rampant display, albeit not in terms of team quality, but individual quality, and we run out 5-2 winners. So at the beginning, to answer the question, I definitely thought there's another bad day at the office, and I was throwing my toys out the pram after 10 minutes.
The point swing is an interesting topic, because at one point over the weekend, last weekend, I think Leicester were losing, and it could conceivably be 20 points now. Mm. If Leicester had lost and City had beaten United and then obviously won last night, as expected, it'd have been 20 points. But then in the first kind of 10 minutes, you're thinking, oh, maybe they'll get beat tonight against Southampton. Mm. Then it's suddenly 8, and that's a 12-point swing in the space of like 5 days. And I know they are obviously going to win the league, and they're deservedly going to win the league. But it did make me think, everyone's been sniggering a little bit at Pep saying, you know, it's nothing's won. Talk to me when we're 11 points clear with 3 games to go, blah, blah, and all that sort of stuff. But he is right, isn't he? If there can be that 12-point swing in the space of 5 days, he does have a point.
Let's just touch on the derby as well and that performance, because Johnny Eyre asked on the emails, did Pep get the selection awry against United? He can never do any serious wrong for me, really. Look at where we are and what we're achieving. But no Foden or Bernardo seemed odd. The side that beat Liverpool is our best side with a false nine, surely. Jack, what did you make of that lineup? Because, again, it was no Foden, no Bernardo. It seems like there was no energy.
Yeah, I thought that they had to find a way of getting Bernardo and Foden into the team because of the player, apart from Mahrez, they're probably the two players that have been at the top of their game for the last month or so. So it was a little bit of a surprise that neither of them played. But then again, you kind of like look at the team he picked and go, well, how are they going to get in? Because even when both De Bruyne and Sterling are kind of faltering slightly, you still have to pick them for a Manchester derby, don't you? I mean, maybe you don't, but it'd be a massive shock if neither of them had played in that game. And then you're thinking, well, where else can you get Silver and Foden in? And he had to play Mahrez because Mahrez has been really good for the last few weeks. You can't drop Mahrez because of his performances lately. So it's a difficult team selection. But yeah, in hindsight, one of them should have played, but I just don't know who he would have removed from the 11, because take Sterling for example, for all his faults in front of goal and the missed chances. I mean, that chance at the end has not really been talked about from the United game, has it?
Yeah,
I mean, that's just an unbelievable miss. For all that, he gives them so much going the other way, and in the as they build up through it and they transition through midfield. So I don't know. They obviously want to play, be able to play with 13 players, but you can't, can you? So
yeah. if he's going to play with a false nine, though, Adam, does that not mean Jesus drops to the bench and one of Foden or Bernardo comes in for that derby?
I was just going to say. So I think Jesus played himself into the derby because of his two goals against Wolves in the match before. I think if he's bang out of form or like injured, like he was against Chelsea away, and again last night. When he's dropped him, and that's allowed him to get Foden and Bernardo and Mahrez on the pitch at the same time. So it's not a case of four going into two positions. You can afford to play them with that false nine. It worked well against Chelsea away, probably the best it's worked this season. And it worked reasonably well last night, albeit a bit of a carnival of chaos, really, at both ends of the pitch. So I think the way you get those two into the side is by dropping Jesus. And I think if hindsight's wonderful, but if we wanted more legs against United, you need to be bringing in Foden and Bernardo. And I think that's at the expense of Jesus and another.
Just on Jesus, when he doesn't play, and they kind of don't click or gel in the final third, and maybe they play a false nine, we always say afterwards, like, they kind of missed Jesus's link-up play, and they missed him harrying the defence, and they missed this and they missed that. So going into the United, like, felt as if Jesus had to play because he's going to occupy those defenders, and he's able to rotate with the others in the front line, and he offers them so much other than the kind of goal scoring element. So I don't know. Maybe this is just a problem with having so many good players, isn't it?
Yeah,
I suppose
it's not. But it's not a simple kind of switch there, is it? Yeah. Let's just touch on the defending, because it's been so good all season, but that's now two successive home games where City have conceded twice. It's four games without a clean sheet. Jack, what do you make of the partnerships that we've seen of this week? Because it was Stones and Diaz for the derby, and then Laporte and Diaz for Southampton.
I didn't think Diaz and Stones were particularly good together. At the weekend, but again, that's allowed because they've been exceptional as a pairing throughout the season. Laporte, I just don't think he's playing well whenever he comes in. I think the issue with Laporte is that when things go badly, and you look at the goals last night, like, Laporte's fingerprints are all over him again. And it happens quite a lot, and they generally concede more goals when he's in the team. I think from now until the end of the season, he's just got to go, right, my back four is Cancelo, Stones, Diaz, Zinchenko, and that's it. And then deal with the consequences afterwards, because they need consistent partnerships all over the pitch, obviously, but the back four needs consistency. And there has been a little bit of chopping and changing recently, and I don't think that's helpful for anyone, and the goalkeeper as well. I don't think it doesn't breed kind of trust, does it, if you've got different people in front of you all the time? And maybe that might cause problems. Well, it would cause problems with Laporte if he just went with Diaz and Stones for the majority of the games, but they're going for all four trophies, and they've got a chance of winning all four trophies, so they've just got to go, right, this is it, this is the best team, this is what we're playing.
Yeah, that said, though, Adam, you know, we talked about Southampton's penalty. United's penalty was clear. Why was Jesus there?
I think it's the ethos of... And I think there's a bit of desperation in all our players, knowing that because the squad's so vast, they can't afford to make a mistake, else they'll be out. It's a case of Gabby gave it away in midfield. It kind of ricocheted off him and led to their attack. And he was... Obviously, there's that ethos as well of winning it back as soon as you lose it. We had ample cover. It's early in the game. You don't need to make those same mistakes. But there was a desperation there in his tracking back and in his challenge. Silly challenge. Lost us the game there and then. We were never really getting back into it after that point. And it's a steep learning curve. I think it was out of desperation, and that I've played myself back into the team. I need to do well because I don't know when my next chance is going to come from. And he's found himself out of the team again after that last night. So I think that was playing in his mind. And I saw as soon as he... as soon as he ricocheted off him, I thought he's chasing this back now. And unfortunately, he tried to get it back when the ball was in our penalty area, when we had about 17 people behind the ball at that point as well. So I think it was a desperation thing.
I was going to say, Jack, have you seen the still image that was doing the rounds? That was like, yeah, like maybe this is overkill when there's six players
the Maradona
around.
It was like that Maradona one, wasn't it? Yeah. maybe the one from the United game was doctored like the Maradona one has been.
let's talk about a few selection issues that Guardiola's got with form, fitness, and getting players into the team. We've touched on De Bruyne already. He was struggling in the derby. Did he put that right on Wednesday, Jack?
Yeah, I guess so. But it's very difficult talking about City with any sort of like nuance at the moment. I think it's just they're just getting through the matches, and De Bruyne playing well against Southampton is just a consequence of De Bruyne being better than the Southampton players. I know that's not a particularly good answer or enlightening answer, but I just think like he's just better than those around him, and the better players win quite a lot.
I'm sorry, but for that point, I need to...
Incredible.
Just drop that in.
I don't know. He's not been the same since he's come back from his injury. I thought against West Ham, he was way off it, and that was masked by the assist, which is a good assist, but it's a very good player putting a cross into a very good area for someone to attack. No one should be surprised that Kevin De Bruyne can do that, even when he's not playing well. There's been more and more talk of whether he gets into City's best 11 at the moment. I think for all I was saying about consistency and selection at the back, I think maybe it's a good idea to kind of leave him out for a game or two, maybe on Saturday.
Is it about minutes in the legs sort of thing at the minute for him?
I thought he probably needed games to get back up to speed, but now I'm thinking maybe less is more with him. Because Guardiola talks about how he's really explosive and he can... I think Sammy asked him about the difference between De Bruyne and Bernardo the other week, and he was really interested in that effectively Bernardo's better for the team and the way they want to play, but De Bruyne is De Bruyne, and De Bruyne will take games away from teams. So actually kind of renders the City setup moot because they have such an extravagant midfielder that can do whatever he wants. If you're looking at him as this explosive playmaker who can create so many chances and score so many goals, maybe I'm wrong in thinking that he needs games to get back up to speed. Maybe it's just that they just drop him in for, you know, maybe have one game in, one game out, or two games in and one game out, just to keep it fresh for him.
Yeah.
Because he can go from looking exceptional one game to then it looking a little bit stale all of a sudden for seemingly no reason.
Yeah. One interesting note of the game against Southampton, Adam, was Aguero came on for not an insignificant amount of time in the end. The game was dead, but there was encouraging signs there from him, I felt.
Yeah, I think when he first came back from his injury, I think it was against Gladbach, his long layoff, he looked fresh, he looked sharp. He didn't play particularly well against West Ham. He was at fault for their goal in terms of giving it away in the build-up. But then last night there was a few nice balls through to him from Foden and Fernandinho. Do we think an Aguero of a couple of years back would have pounced onto them a bit more comfortably? But he's certainly showing signs of getting back there, and I would have him in the team. People will argue and say there's no space for sentimentality, but I'd have Aguero in the team until he says I don't want to play anymore. That could be when he's 60, when he's 70. For what he's done for the club, all the sentimentality in the world, I'll get slated for that, but I've got to stick to my guns. There's a respect and loyalty thing. I know we're in a results business, and I don't think Guardiola does loyalties and sentiment. So I'm probably one of a minority on that. But I'd have him in the team every week, and he probably needs to be back in the team every week to find that rhythm and to find that goal-scoring form again. He's gone, I think, 13 Premier League games without a goal now, his longest run ever. 414 days or whatever it is without a goal now. So, you know, that'll start weighing on him. I think he's got a point to prove. We know he's playing for a contract, which is such a sad state of affairs. It's like watching your dad get beat up outside a pub when Sergio can't run like he could in 2012. But yeah, for me, I'm probably a bit weak here when I say I'd give him the keys to the sitter.
I was a little bit surprised by a lot of people on Sunday, quite like taken aback and almost angry. And I'm not saying not City fans at all, but like people kind of from outside of the bubble, if you will, that they were flabbergasted that Aguero wasn't called for. And I saw pictures that people took of the bench and going, oh, imagine a Manchester derby without bringing this guy on. It's like, well, follow the pattern of what's happened at City over the last year. Like, Aguero is a bit part player and isn't able to do what Guardiola wants a striker to do at the moment because he needs matches to get fit, but City don't have the time to allow him to get match fit. So unfortunately, both of them are a victim of circumstance. And I think that was, to be honest, I think West Ham was proof of that.
Yeah.
In that Aguero was just wasn't quite there. And that's all right, that's fine, it's not his fault because he's not played. But they can't afford him the time to get up to speed. So I think I wrote this from the West Ham game. I think there will be a moment this season when they are chasing a goal and they feel he is sufficiently ready to come on in the last 20 minutes and get him a goal. And I think he will score a big goal for them. But I don't think that he's going to fight his way back into the team before the end of the year. I just don't see it.
Yeah. I'm going to finish the first part of the show, Adam, with one of your stats from after the game against Southampton. what do you think Guardiola has against hat-trick scorers? Because that's 22 times now he's taken somebody off when they're on a brace. Mahrez scored his second goal and then got 6 more minutes. De Bruyne scored his second goal and then got 13 more minutes. It's almost like Guardiola saying, no, you can't have a match ball.
Yeah, he's kind of like, I'll keep you grounded. I think that's his message going out there. I was asked that stat, and when I looked into the database, it was staggeringly more than I thought. I'd assumed it, but it's just ridiculous. So he's definitely keeping them grounded. I think that's the aspect he's going at.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
Right, as Liverpool's title defence gets closer to being over, City now needs 6 more points to be sure of finishing above them. The questions are once again being raised about whether this is the worst title defence ever. The same was asked of City last season and in 2013 and 2015. It's also recently been asked of Leicester and Chelsea after poor showings as defending champions. The truth is, the worst ever title defence does belong to City, and Liverpool aren't going to get close to beating it. I've been speaking to Manchester football historian Dr. Gary James about the time that City were relegated after winning the league.
This is something that it matters immensely to City fans because we had the worst ever title defence, and it wasn't in 2012 and 13, it wasn't in 2014, 15 and so on. It was back in 1937-38. And I remember, what was it? Was it 5, 6, 7 years ago or whatever when the first tried to claim that City's title defence was the worst ever? I ended up at the time sort of putting on social media saying, oh no, it's not. No. We've done worse. Never mind. In fact, we are the worst. And it's one of those things that we should be proud of in some ways that it's happened to us. I know it's a bonkers thing, but now that we've won all these trophies, we should talk about it. The fact is that 1936-37, we won the title. We were fantastic. We had some of the biggest names in football. was a player called Peter Doherty, who was a star man, a star striker, if you like. We had players like Eric Brooke. We had all this goalkeeper, Frank Swift. We had all this talented team, and we won the title in style. Everyone celebrated it. We went to Germany and played a friendly in the well, we played a number of friendlies, but a friendly in the Berlin Olympic Stadium against Germany. You know, we didn't just play a club side, we played against Germany. And we were a major, major team. And then 1937-38 season starts, and I think part of it is that the captain, Sam Barker, perhaps set the tone by saying in the press, we want to win the big trophy now. We want to win the FA Cup. Right. Now, that is true for the time that people viewed the FA Cup as being the more glamorous one in some ways because of the showpiece final at Wembley. But by saying that so early in the season, I think he sort of doomed us to have a bad league campaign. Because it's, you know, if the captain's saying at the start, it's not the league that matters this year, it's the FA Cup. What's it going to do?
Exactly. I mean, the thing is, there was a time as well when Leicester, a couple of years ago, when they won the title, and then the next season they were struggling in the Premier League, and I'm thinking, you know what, I really hope they don't go down, because there's a badge of honour there, isn't there, as City as the only defending champions relegated?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, when back in 1926, City reached the FA Cup final and were relegated in the same season, it was the first time that happened. So when Wigan beat us in 2013 and got relegated, that was like a double whammy for me, because not only did they beat us in the FA Cup final, but they then also got relegated as FA Cup winners, and that really upset me. And I know other teams have, you know, sort of that relegated and cup final thing in the same season, other teams have done that, but even so, it was like a double whammy. So, yeah, we need to protect this. We don't want, well, I was going to say we don't want teams to get relegated that have just won the title so we can preserve it, but I might make an exception in Liverpool's case. But really, we don't. We certainly didn't want Leicester to get relegated. I mean, that season, we started off, we won our home games in the first sort of, you know, four or five home games we won. But we lost our away games, and that affected it. And straight away, the media, who were not typically critical back then, but if you were the champions and then you started off, in their eyes, unable to make us at least mid-table, they would give you some criticism and they'd ask, where has it gone wrong? And City were asked, where had it gone wrong so early in the season? And there were no answers, because basically it was more or less the same team. In fact, they actually strengthened during the season. There were some injuries, but not significant injuries. And it was just one of those things. Like, they'd turn up for a game where you'd expect them to win, you know, 3-0 or whatever, and then they'd lose it. And so it's difficult to say, why did it go wrong? Why did they fail that year? But they obviously did.
Yeah, looking at that title as well, it was City's first ever title. And so it's kind of like, what a way to go after your first ever title.
Yeah, do it in style. You'll always be remembered. And City, you know, they also had all those attendance records, and the 1930s was a truly great period for City. And I often talk about this as being the first truly golden era for a club. You know, there'd been the success at the start of the century, which was taken away from City because of the bribe scandal and everything that followed that. But then in the 1930s, they were at the, you know, that main road, they're getting enormous crowds for key games. They were setting records. You know, they built the league record crowd. They also got the 84,000 crowd, which still stands today, record, and so on. Right, and then people will say to me, you know, critics, fans of other clubs will say to me, yeah, but those champions got relegated, didn't they? As if it negates all of that, and I think it adds to it really that we were such a giant, such a big club, such a team that had all this success. And we, even us, even the mighty Manchester City of the 1930s, could get relegated. And that, in some ways, also gives hope that, you know, even the mighty Liverpool, Manchester United, Arsenal, whoever it may be, could still get relegated. I know it's much more difficult now in some ways because of finance really has changed the dynamics of the entire league. But it is still possible. You know, Leeds United in the 90s, they won the league, and look what happened to them. they had an awful sort of 20 odd years, 30 years that followed. And it's quite often happened that a team can win the league, but then has a really fallow few years that follow.
So obviously, Gary, they went down the following season after winning the title. How did that end up happening?
Well, you know, they had a bad spell in February, March, where they went something like 9-10 games or something like that without winning. It was poor form, and that really put them in the sort of bottom three and bottom two and struggling. And they were, on the last day of the season, they were playing Huddersfield Town. Both teams, there was about seven teams that could go down that year, and both City and Huddersfield Town, playing at Huddersfield, but both City and Huddersfield Town could go down, and they only needed a point each, a point for both teams, and they'd survive. So obviously you'd think neither side would really take too much of a risk, that both teams would be quite careful and so on. City didn't do that. City tried to attack. We had a goal. Well, we thought it was a goal, but it was basically, it was one of those where it hits the crossbar, comes down, crosses the line. But of course, only the City players say it crossed the line. The opposition don't say it crossed the line. The referee didn't see it, that blah, blah, blah. The linesman didn't see it, all that sort of thing. And it ended up that Huddersfield actually scored. And so 1-1-0. And we got relegated. But we would still have been up if one of four other teams had lost. There was Grimsby, Portsmouth, Birmingham and Stoke, and they all won. All those teams won, and nobody would have ever expected that. If just one of them had have dropped a point, if one of them had have got 1 point rather than the two that you used to get, City would have survived on goal average. But instead, City got relegated. So even that, it was, and the goal that Huddersfield scored was in the 72nd minute. It was 18 minutes from time, and you just think all you needed to do was shut up shop. But it was very much, I was at the 83 relegation game against Luton, and it was very much similar to that, in that one of those two teams could go down, and in the end Huddersfield did enough to survive. But if it had been a draw, both teams would have survived, and that would have been it. City would have been safe.
Yeah, it reminds me of 97-98 as well. They won at Stoke, but Portsmouth and Port Vale both won as well.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that was another one. And also that relegation game from the Premier League against Liverpool, where we're time-wasting the corner. And it's like, for God's sake, you know, it's the last game of the season.
Just do something.
Yeah, and the team, the City team, truly, they were still international players. They were not too old. You know, some people were saying, oh, maybe the team got too old, but the age was around about the same as most of the other teams in the league. It was more or less the average. It wasn't anything ridiculous. And they got relegated. And unfortunately as well, that relegation then was one of those moments that changed Manchester football for some time, because United were a second division team and got promoted that year. City couldn't get promoted in 38-39. Then war comes along, suspends football, and by the time the league resumes after the war, City, you know, the entire football scene has changed. Suddenly United are starting to get bigger crowds than City, which had never happened before, really. And United were in the first division, and City was still in the second division when football resumed after the war. And that set the tone for the next 10, 20 years, really.
For a pledge of $2 a month, you can hear our weekly bonus show on a wide range of City topics. There's more details on patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
That was Gary James talking to me about the 1938 City side. Time now to look ahead to the games with Fulham and Borussia Mönchengladbach. Jack, we've been talking a lot about the selection and kind of what options Guardiola has for him for the coming games. What do you think he'll do against Fulham, given the kind of situation against Gladbach?
There'll be, I mean, how many changes were there last night? Five, I think, or six. And the kind of general rule over the last few weeks has been around five on average. So I think there'll be changes again. Maybe Foden and Bernardo will both play again. Mahrez probably dropped to the bench, given, I couldn't believe actually Mahrez last night was the first time he started six Premier League games on the trot ever for City. Just goes to show the strength in depth, doesn't it? They paid £60 million for that fella.
Yeah.
I don't know. It'd be interesting at the back. and how he approaches that, because is Ake fit enough for some minutes? Because again, he wasn't on the bench last night. He's not been seen since December. He'll treat it as a big game, because even though, as we've said before, the league is won, he won't want to slip up. So I think Diaz and Stones, is that a fair? I think he'll probably go strong as possible in the middle, and then give Walker a rest, and then Walker might play against Gladbach. Rodri will be back, won't he? And then does he go false nine again, or does he probably play Jesus? So actually, it's going to be about five or six again, I think.
Yeah.
They're not weakened teams, are they? That's the thing.
That's what I was going to get at, for because the interesting thing here, Adam,
that's a long meandering way of saying he's going to make some changes. Is that?
Well, I think. Let's be honest, Mike.
Incredible.
Let's just keep that one going. Adam, is this an opportunity for Aguero to start again now? Because like against West Ham, you know, he wasn't great, but he needs the minutes. This is possibly one of those games, although Fulham could be a bit dangerous. They are playing quite well at the moment.
Yeah, as I alluded to earlier, I'd like Aguero to start. I think this is the type of game we can afford him to start in. I know that sounds ridiculous, that you're trying to crowbar someone like Aguero into your side. It was interesting, though. I agree with Jack, there will be changes, and that's been the pattern of play recently. But Pep's comments last night after the game, where he says there's going to be less changes and I'm only going to choose the players that want to do well for the club and the team, and the rest can sit on the bench. I can't really envisage who he's speaking about categorically, but it'll be interesting to see who, because he's classing this as the business end of the season now. Which players he says he's going to choose the players that have helped him so far this season. Now I'm trying to read between the lines and not coming up with anything, to be honest, because there's no scandal nowadays. They're such a guarded and protected club, so it's interesting. We will need to make changes. I agree. Rodri will be coming back in. I suspect Walker might rest, and he's probably the right player for a Gladbach match. So yeah, I think Aguero. These are the type of games, like we say, we're running out of games to give these people minutes who need them. Fulham away, with all due respect, and they've been playing well. I expect it to be a cagey affair, but I think Sergio might be able to be the difference on that type of game. A smaller pitch, so less running, or it seems seemingly smaller pitch, so he doesn't need to stretch his legs too much, and hopefully he can unlock something for us like he has there previously. So
yeah, Jack, like we're touching on there, Fulham have crept into a little bit of form. They've given themselves, I'd say, a chance of staying up, because you know, it's looking like Newcastle and Brighton might be in a bit of danger there. If City's winning run had continued, I guess like going into this game, we'd all be feeling fine. But because they've conceded a couple of goals in recent games and the performances were a bit iffy at times, like, is there a danger that this is a tougher test than we're maybe giving it credit for?
I think it is a tougher test, because Fulham have started winning games from nowhere, and aren't conceding as many goals as they were doing, and are like nicking games. I mean, they nicked it against Sheffield United, and they defended brilliantly against Liverpool to win there. I saw them at Burnley the other week, actually. I thought they were, and that was just after they'd beaten Everton, but they won one game in, I don't know, 300, and it was the Everton game. But I thought they were really good. I was quite surprised. I'd not seen them live for. I don't know whether I'd seen them live all season, to be honest, and they're not the sort of club that, if they're on the telly, that I'll even have it on the background. Because wow, in fact, there are some clubs where you look at like the TV guide, it's like, well, I'm not watching that. Chelsea, every time Chelsea are on, it's like, well, I'm not even having that on in the background. I'm not bothered. It's weird, isn't it? I don't know why. Anyway,
I'm not going to say, like, Burnley's one of mine, and like, you have to go, you cover them all the time. So like,
yeah, but I could talk to you about Burnley all day. Burnley are better than people give them credit for, and actually play some relatively good stuff at times. But because it rarely leads to a goal, it never gets onto Match of the Day. So it's kind of like, it's just a cycle. Because it doesn't get onto the highlights, people like you don't see it, so therefore you don't watch him, and then you think the crap.
I'll tell you what, I'll give myself one of these, Sean.
Incredible.
There we go.
They are coming to... I think it's a bit of a banana skin, personally. But City are so adept at just swatting these teams away that you can't look beyond them winning it at a canter.
Yeah, the Gladbach game in midweek, Adam, has been moved to exactly the same venue that the previous leg was played at. That, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it probably doesn't mean anything, but it kind of makes the away goals rule a bit of a farce for this, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be typical City to get knocked out on away goals from a tie we never played at home, but I think that's the case for anyone who plays in Budapest. I just think with the current climate, there should be allowances made to change the format of the competition, mirror what they did in the Champions League last year and have one tie.
Oh, I forgot, you're a big Champions League one leg.
Oh, I'm mini tournament, the Festival of Football. Yeah, yeah, God, yeah, get it all in one place and have a World Cup of Champions League football. So I think just for this season, anything at this knockout stage should have just been one game. It alleviates any logistical issues for teams travelling from high COVID countries and COVID rulings and stuff. So the fact that it's at that neutral venue again is a bit of a strange one. It annoys me from a geeky stats point of view because I need to have a home game at a different stadium like we did with Oakwell back in early 2000s, mid-2000s. So, I don't like the nuances of having a home game 100 miles
somewhere
away.
Else. Yeah.
Yeah, somewhere else. So I'm a bit of a traditionalist, and if you do need to change it, now would be the perfect time to change the format. So I think they should have done that, but it's an interesting quirk, I suppose.
It's very, very short notice, that Budapest thing.
Yeah.
Because they've all been short notice if they're going to be played in Budapest or wherever else. But City, Gladbach and UEFA all thought up until a couple of days ago that it was going to be played at the Etihad. Mm. And they were all planning for that. And then I'm presuming that the travel restrictions in that particular region of Germany have changed overnight, and then they all had to change the plans. But everyone had, like, as of, well, last week, this game is definitely being played at the Etihad because the restrictions in that region aren't quite as strict as they were in Leipzig's region as a comparison. So it's not good at all for it to be so late in the day. I'm surprised Pep didn't mention it actually last night.
I'm kind of quite au fait with it, just simply because, like, it's the world we're living in at the moment. Things change at the drop of a hat because of the coronavirus, so you kind of have to kind of roll with it. I'm interested, Jack, in Guardiola's comments after the last Gladbach game, where he was talking about 2-0 and he wasn't very happy with the situation, a bit worried that you know the job wasn't done, sort of thing, even though people were saying it was. And he's kind of dropped the hint again and again that City aren't ready to take on the Champions League. And I'm just wondering, if they're not ready now, when will they be ready?
Probably when they spend 100 million quid on Erling Haaland. Or do you want me to carry on?
Is that it?
Incredible.
he has mentioned it a lot since Gladbach. And he mentioned it again last night, basically giving goals away. And he was good on it on Tuesday, pre-match. He was good on it as well. It's the same old problems. It's just defensive. Well, not even defensive concentration. It's just concentration on the ball and giving it away. And I mean, the Southampton game, I think it was, I've not seen a replay of this, but I think it was Walker that gave it away on the touchline on the right-hand side, which allowed Southampton to play one pass, which has basically bypassed the whole midfield. Redmond's had a shot from outside the box. Edison's tipped it wide for a corner. Then they concede from the corner, and it all leads to them giving the ball away on the touchline needlessly. And those are the sort of things, if that happens in a Champions League game against a better team than Southampton, they go out. Yeah. And this is why he doesn't think that they're going to be able to win it. But then, like, the flip side of that is if they play like they did do for the majority of the 21 games, they've got every chance of winning it. But the Gladbach game, the last minute of that, or the last kick of that first leg, Edison pulls off a wonder save to keep it at 2-0. And that, again, that is And if a that's lack of concentration.
If that's if the other way,
2-1, it's a different game.
Yeah, and if that's the other way round as well on that stadium, it's the home game, and that's an away goal if it goes in. So
yeah.
That's
why I think he's worried about it. But they've set up as solidly as they possibly can do. So I don't really understand. I don't see how they can eradicate those problems in such a short space of time.
Yeah. Right, well, no winners on this week's charity bet. Who could have seen a 5-2 against Southampton coming, in all honesty? But it means we stay on £890 for the season so far. That money is going to the Christie, a cancer treatment hospital in Manchester, and each of us is getting a £10 correct score single on City's games from William Hill to add to the pot. Going to start with the game against Fulham. Adam, what have you got?
I know you don't do goal scorers, but I'm going 1-0 Aguero.
Well, 1-0 is 5-1 and £50. Then for Gladbach, what are you having?
2-0, mirror result of the last one.
It's mirror odds as well, because that's 5-1 as well, and £50 if you're right. Jack, Fulham, what are you having?
3-1.
3-1 City is 10-1 and £100. And then for Gladbach?
2-1.
That's 15-2 and £75. I've done exactly the same as you, Jack, but I've swapped the scores around. So 2-1 against Fulham is 15-2 and £75. And 3-1 against Gladbach is 9-1 and £90. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for more on responsible gambling, have a look at begambleaware.org. Now, all the talk last summer was whether City were going to complete the signing of Lionel Messi, as his future at Barcelona looked bleak. It's been rumoured that he'd still make the move to Manchester when his contract expires in a few months' time, but things may have changed a little bit with Joan Laporta winning the elections there. What does that mean for Barcelona, Messi and City, and even Sergio Aguero? I've been speaking to journalist and Barcelona fan Rafael Hernandez to find out more.
The big news is that Laporta was elected president. It was inevitable, but at the same time, it wasn't. We still had Barcelona fans worried that he might not win. And all Barcelona fans knew that if Messi was to stay, Laporta had to be elected. So the moment that Laporta was elected, he said that he was going to talk with Messi and he will try to find a way for Messi to stay at Barcelona. And he already said it loud and clear that Messi is going to have to compromise part of his finances. So if Messi stays, he's going to earn at least, I would say, even half of what he earns right now, which is really, really a lot. He was getting over 100 million per year. So yeah, you can imagine that it's really a lot of money, and Barca are nearly bankrupt. So there's absolutely no way that he could stay earning the same thing. And basically Laporta said it, and then Laporta came, he's actually at the club today, and basically he's talking with everyone there, talking with Koeman, and he already met Messi, he already called Messi, and he said it quite clear to everyone that he cannot guarantee that Messi is going to stay, but he's going to give his all to actually persuade Messi to stay with a solid project.
I mean, obviously, last time we spoke, it was up in the air whether or not Messi would be leaving, or whether, you know, even City could come in for him on a free transfer and with the clause in his contract, that sort of thing. Obviously, his contract is up at the end of the season. Is there still a decision for him to make now, or do you get the impression that he'd be quite happy to stay at Barcelona for the remaining years of his career?
Yeah, honestly, the way that he has reacted to Laporta winning the election, apparently he was very happy alongside the players. So, yeah, I would say that the chances of Messi leaving have really shortened by quite a bit, if I'm honest. You have the situation where Messi is at Barcelona in his entire life. Basically, he has his whole family, and he said it himself in the interview with Goal last August that the most difficult thing about leaving Barcelona was making his whole family move between countries. And this is not about Manchester's weather or anything like that, because rival fans love to say it's about that, but it absolutely isn't. So yeah, I would say that the possibility of Messi leaving right now is really small, just because his family is there. He's quite happy now that the club is back on track, basically. But it's not, I wouldn't say it's, I am 100% certain that he is staying, because it's never that simple, and Messi will have everything in his hands. He won't have a contract by the time that he starts to talk with Barcelona to renew it, to actually sign a new contract. It's not about renewing anymore. It's about persuading him to stay.
I mean, the other interesting aspect of the saga last summer was that City fans were dreaming of having Lionel Messi lining up alongside Sergio Aguero. I guess the fear for City fans now is that it could still happen, but just the other way around, because Laporta was talking about potentially trying to sign Aguero, was he?
Yeah, Aguero is one of the big names that there were rumors on social media possibly coming from Laporta's own camp that this could happen, but it's not set in stone. I would say that it's possible that Aguero could come to Barcelona, maybe on a short contract, maybe one or two years. And yes, absolutely, I think it would be a good bargaining chip with Messi, without a doubt, because him and Aguero are really, really close, closer than people think. And you already had one of the big streamers in Spain basically saying that Aguero could come to Barcelona, and apparently he has some contacts with Aguero's camp too. So I would say it's a possibility, but it's not set in stone right now, because Barca are in a really poor situation in terms of finances. So it's going to take a while for Laporta to actually make an assessment of the finances to see if Alaba will come, if Aguero will come, because I would say that between Alaba and Aguero, Alaba is the priority for Barcelona because of his position. He could play as a centre back, he could play as a left back. So there's that too.
Yeah, I mean, the other interesting aspect, of course, is the other name that kind of muddies the waters somewhat is that of Erling Haaland, because obviously City would be interested if that deal could be done. If that means that Aguero moves on, there's so many different cogs in this machine for this coming summer it's really hard to predict, isn't it?
Yeah, honestly, I think it's impossible to predict, because we actually don't know the real state of Barcelona's finances. I'm sure everyone read that the former president was just arrested, so he was basically laundering money to shell companies, and one of the shell companies that he was using was actually financing outright or something like that, some kind of right-winger movement against the Catalonia's independence. So you get that Barcelona, which is a club really linked with the Catalan independence, was actually being used to finance anti-independence movement. So it's really a messy situation. So I would say, yeah, we really don't know how bad things are in terms of money for Barca. And of course, we have had rumors from both Victor Fonts and Laporta's camps that Haaland could be signed, but Laporta never actually mentioned the Haaland by name. He kept insisting that he had a good relationship with all of the big agents in the world, and of course it means Mino Raiola too. Laporta is actually really close with Mino, so it wouldn't be an issue, but at the end of the day, it's really about money. And we can't really think that Haaland could come to Barcelona and basically accept to earn even half of what he could earn at Real Madrid or Manchester City.
What's your gut instinct on the future for this? Do you expect Messi to stay at Barcelona and Aguero maybe to stay at City if the contract offers there?
Honestly, I think that Messi will stay. I would say that basically the whole fan base is acting like he will stay, and I'm confident too, given the whole how he has reacted to Laporta's being elected was a really, really strong news. We had Messi's father, who's also his agent, actually liking the Laporta's post on Instagram too. The whole of the footballers at the club are actually happy that Laporta is the president. So you have this really push. And you have the whole comfort zone for Messi. We can call it that too. Yeah, so in my opinion, Messi is going to stay. And there is a possibility that Aguero could be signed. Same for Alaba. But really, when it comes to Haaland, if it is to happen this summer, I really don't believe that Barcelona have the financial means for it.
Get involved with the debate on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
Rafael Hernandez there on Barcelona's situation at the moment. Time to finish with Ask the Panel. Get your questions in for next week on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast. You can email us as well. Just go to bluemoonpodcast.com and fill out the form there. First up is Mark Forsyth on Facebook, actually, who says, given the scenes at Rangers and Liverpool when they won their titles, do you think, assuming City win the title, and I'm old school, so not counting my chickens just yet, City should take some precautions, or can City fans be trusted not to disgrace the club? Adam, what do you reckon? Because this is, when City win their title, let's assume that City are going to win this title and that a massive swing isn't going to happen. When that happens, the restrictions are likely to be a little bit lighter than they are now.
Yeah, and without being a spoilt prince, our title won't be as a bigger shock as it was when Liverpool won it or Rangers won theirs in terms of time without a trophy. So I think our celebrations would rightly be muted in terms of, yes, there'd be an element of it's a human nature to want to rebel and go and celebrate near your club's ground, whether the restrictions allow, if the restrictions don't allow. We saw a smattering of that when Silva's last game during lockdown, and some fans visited the stadium and greeted the coach. And I've widely condemned on here the act of people breaching lockdown in those type of celebrations. The Liverpool title celebrations, I understand it, but you've got to be less selfish. And I'd be sad. We've got a good track record as City fans. Like you look at the Munich anniversary at the Derby, we observed that and we were coined impeccable from then. But like I say, there was a smattering of fans there for the silver final. So I'd expect that we will see fans gathering at the stadium, and that's, you know, their choice. I'd like to not think we're better than that, and we're a more considerate bunch. But I do expect some celebrations at the stadium. You'd be right in hoping that lockdowns will be lifted and we'll be lucky enough to be able to see some kind of presentation or interaction, because Liverpool weren't afforded that, and they might have won and lost the title without a fan seeing it from their point of view. So I'm hoping, fingers crossed, we're lucky and we can celebrate together.
Yeah. Jack, do you think the club will be worrying about this, maybe?
Yeah, I don't know. I've not asked, but I don't think there's a great deal that the club can do, really. You've just got to kind of hope that everybody observes the rules. And there's an element of supporter at every single club up and down the country that don't abide the rules and wouldn't. But I suppose every club's got to hope that their minority is smaller than the minority of other other clubs. It's just, what can you do? You can enlist more kind of police on the ground, which costs money. I don't know. It's kind of a hope and pray that they don't see the scenes Anfield or Ibrox, which I don't think they will, because Adam said winning a title is always massive, but it's not as significant. This wouldn't be as significant as Rangers winning the first one for the first 10 years after the first one in 10 years after the financial problems they've had, etc. And Celtic's 9 in a row, and Liverpool have gone 30 years without one. It's not the same, but that doesn't mean to say that people won't still turn up. So I don't know. It's a wait and see. But I guess there'd be. History suggests that City will hope that it'll be okay.
Yeah. Gavin Thompson from Patreon asks, the most effective midfield three to me this season has been Rodric, Gundogan and Bernardo. With De Bruyne fit, it seems Bernardo is the favourite to drop out, and based on recent games, that's made us weaker there. Do you agree that there's an argument for not guaranteeing De Bruyne a game in the central three for the decisive games this season? Jack, we touched on this before, but this is, for the decisive games this season, it's a big call, isn't it, like you were saying with the derby?
Yeah, it's a huge call. I mean, if the Champions League final was tomorrow, then Kevin De Bruyne plays, doesn't he? Maybe in a way, in the kind of what you were alluding to before, maybe there's a way of getting them all in and not playing and going with a false nine, or as they did at West Brom, which was a false 9, 10, and an 11. maybe that's the way to do it, and Jesus and Aguero don't play. I quite like De Bruyne when he's just allowed to play central and do whatever he wants, basically. I think they get a lot out of him when he plays like that. So maybe that's the way to go in the bigger matches. But I completely take the point that Bernardo is such a different player this year to what he was last year, and he had his problem last year, and I think he was a little bit lonely in Manchester, and he likes living in the city, but I think he struggled being away from certain people last year, and the stuff with the FA and the Mendy tweet hurt him, and he went backwards, and now he's come out the other side of that. I don't think he was great on Wednesday night, but he still affected the game, and that's what you need from that kind of front six, where, you know, if Silva's not playing well but still affecting it, he knows that someone else is gonna win him the game. And last night it was De Bruyne and Mahrez, and when De Bruyne and Mahrez aren't quite at it, they know that Bernardo or Foden will win them the game. So I think, like, Pep loves a midfielder, and maybe it will be in the Champions League that he goes and plays six midfielders and says, go on, do whatever you want.
Yeah. If the Champions League was tomorrow, Adam, would you play De Bruyne in it?
I put a tweet out the other week saying that Gundogan and De Bruyne can't play in the same midfield. And what I mean by that is you don't get the same Gundogan if De Bruyne's in the side. I'd always play De Bruyne, but we'd need to probably sacrifice a striker to get De Bruyne and Gundogan in. Leave De Bruyne just to be marauding forward and being penetrative up front, and leave Gundogan to create. We saw Gundogan's best run of form this season when De Bruyne was out of the side. I got absolutely panned for suggesting they can't play in the same midfield, so I'm expecting a backlash again off that. But you've got to stick to your opinion, and I believe you don't get the same Gundogan with De Bruyne in there. So I'd sacrifice a striker to get them both in.
I'll tell you what, I'll give you one of these to finish.
Incredible.
There we go. Right, well, that brings this week's Blooming Podcast to an end. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks to my guest from statcity.co.uk, Adam Carter.
Thank you very much.
And the Daily Mail's Jack Gaunt.
Thank you, mate. Cheers.
If you'd like to get future podcasts completely ad-free, then you can sign up to our Patreon page on any of the three tiers. They're now all priced in your local currency, so none of that converting from US dollars if you're somewhere else in the world. And all three tiers offer the same benefits, so you can pick the one that's right for you. Have a look at patreon.com/bluemoonpodcast. If you sign up, you'll also get an extra podcast each week for Patreon backers. This week, I've been chatting to Duncan Alexander from Opta to decide whether City are the most interesting team of the Premier League era, with some of the records that they've set or that they currently hold. All the details for that as well are on patreon.com/bluemoonpodcast. Please don't forget to give us a rating and a review in all the usual places, and we'll be back next week, so I'll see you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please support the show. Patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.